Natural Resources to order. I know we'll have some members kind of dribbling in here, but we need to get started so that we give our guests the maximum amount of time. They have a plane to catch this afternoon, so that's the primary reason for our being here and being together is to hear from the folks from Utah, and then we will go over the bill just as a review that it hasn't been introduced yet, and both committees will ultimately be having hearings on that bill and be hearing from DNR at that time. We won't take the time today to do that. So thank you very much for joining us. I'll turn it over to Senator Cruz to make introductions, and he knows that he's not going to talk too long, so he gives them the maximum amount of time to talk, right?
That's right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Thank you for being here. What we have before us today, and as Madam Chair mentioned, we are on some pretty strict time constraints. These folks have to be on a plane at about 5 o'clock, so our goal is to get them up and out of here at about 5 minutes, 10 to 4, and we're going to rush them out to the airport. So just to make sure that we can operate within those time constraints, I do want to just very quickly go over the legislation, which you have a copy of in your packets. That was dropped in the hopper today. Will be introduced in the Senate on Thursday. Very quickly, what the legislation does is it establishes a Legislative Citizens Permanent School Trust Fund Commission comprised of two public members appointed by the Speaker of the House, two public members appointed by the Senate Rules Subcommittee, four public members appointed by the Governor, three members appointed from the Senate, three members appointed from the House, and those members are bipartisan members, so there will be representation from both the majority and minority caucuses with those. Further in your packets, you're going to find some very quick documents. I have a two-page summary of a legislative auditor's report. If you have time, I would definitely go online and take a look at that full report. It is dated, but we do have many of the same concerns that were expressed in that report still holding true today. So if you get an opportunity, look at that summary, and if you feel so inclined, go on and get the full report. I actually also have a sheet in there that goes through all the fund balances for the school trust land account up to date, so I think you'll find that helpful. And then also we have an assessment that was done by the Minnesota State Board of Investment that has to do with some investment opportunities that the fund did not take advantage of, and kind of briefly looks at what the financial implications of that were. With that, I would like to introduce Margaret Bird, who is the director of Utah's Children Land Alliance Supporting Schools, and Kevin Carter, who is the director of Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. Phenomenal resources. The system that we are looking to structure our reforms after here in Minnesota are very similar to what they were able to do in Utah. So that's why we have them before us today, it's been a pleasure. So I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you.
Welcome, Margaret Bird. I don't know if you've had a chance to meet Senator Ingebrigtsen, who chairs the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and both of our committees. I visited, was at the Permanent School Trust Advisory Committee earlier this week in general. So.
And we met you on our previous trip,
yes.
I believe, to Minnesota.
Yes, we did.
My name is Margaret Bird. I work for the State Office of Education on behalf of the beneficiary with oversight over the management of the school lands and the investment of the permanent fund. And then we also administer the program that puts some money in each school. I also represent a national organization called the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, or CLASS for short. And CLASS is an organization of people, advocates that are committed to seeing that school trust lands make revenue for schools and make a difference in the lives and education of children. Our presentation is on the school trust lands that are a sacred, irrevocable trust granted to you at statehood with all the full restrictions that are placed upon a trustee. The United States Supreme Court has had a number of cases that have involved school trust lands. This is just one of the quotes from one of the cases, which indicates all these restrictions in combination indicate Congress's concern both that the grants provide the most substantial support possible to the beneficiaries and that only those beneficiaries profit from the trust. As we go through these things, I hope you'll reflect on where you are right now in your state as to this. There have been numerous state Supreme Court decisions on the trust. These are but a few of the ones that I just picked a smattering from several different states, some closer to you than others. But they indicate the seriousness with which state Supreme Courts take the way in which a state is administering its trust. Trustees are held to a very, very high standard. Perhaps the most quoted court decision on trust is the next one, on fiduciary duty. And this one says, a trustee is held to something stricter than the morals of the marketplace, not honesty alone, but the punctilio of an honor. The most sensitive is then the standard of behavior. The level of conduct for fiduciaries has been kept at a level higher than that trodden by the crowd. That is the level, the fiduciary level, which the state of Minnesota has assumed when they accepted the school trust lands in your state. Fiduciary duties require a number of things. If you want a more extensive list of fiduciary duties, you can find them on the class website, which is childrenslandalliance.org. This is a shortened version of perhaps the ones that are most often before state Supreme Courts. But the highest the highest requirement is that of undivided loyalty, which, of course, all of us in this room can understand, because if you set up a trust for your children or your grandchildren, it means that the person who administers that trust has to only consider the needs of the beneficiaries or of your children or grandchildren, which would mean that even though providing a home for homeless people might be a very noble action on your part as a trustee, you could not do that because that wouldn't be undivided loyalty to the children who were the recipient of that trust. There is also a high duty of accountability. The trustee has a responsibility to be providing to that beneficiary a full accounting not only of the revenue that is made, but of the expenses that they incur in making that revenue. So that means that your school system or your schools should be receiving a level of accounting that is necessary. In Utah, I receive once a month a full accounting by every single program on exactly how much they've made for every dollar that's been spent. There is a duty not to commingle accounts. In other words, you should not be administering the trust lands commingled with some other lands or some other trust that might have other objectives than the school children. There's a duty to obtain the very best possible price. And many times the courts have said you can't simply sell a piece of property at what an appraisal has said it's worth. You need to go to an auction so that you can actually establish what the market value of that is. So the courts have been pretty strict on that one. The duty to inform the beneficiary, and the duty, of course, to preserve the trust, because I hope if there's one thing you remember, or I hope there are two things you remember from my testimony today, and one is that the full fiduciary duty is upon the state as far as the school trust lands go. And the second one is, this is a forever trust. The beneficiaries of this trust are not just the children today. The beneficiaries are the children, the next generation and the next and the next. And it is incredible to me how those states that have honored this trust, on how the funding has had a tremendous impact within their state. There have been times, 2 years ago, the state of Montana funded one-fifth of all of their education cost out of their trust. There have been times when the state of New Mexico has funded one-third of all their education cost from their trust. In the United States, still today, there are still 45 million acres of school trust land supporting schools, and there are $49 billion of funds generating interest and dividends for the support of schools. So it's very important to remember that this trust is a forever trust. Whoops, went the wrong way, didn't I? The basis for the trust is the Enabling Act that enabled each state to be a state. It set out the conditions for statehood, and in the states joining the Union, not the original 13, but in the others, in the Enabling Act, it lays out the conditions for the trust, state to be a state. It set out the conditions for statehood, and in the states joining the Union, not the original 13, but in the others, in the Enabling Act, it lays out the conditions for the trust. But the intent is still the same, and that is that there is a beneficiary, and it is the public schools of the state. 1994 was the year in which we made changes to the management of the school lands in the state of Utah. I had worked from 1973 till 1994 on trying to make changes on our management. At that time, we were within the Department of Natural Resources, and the school lands were providing a marginal amount of money to the schools, and no one even knew what it did because it went into the big education pot. And then the State Office of Education was given the pot. So no one knew how much came in. However much came in from school trust lands leaked out from some other revenue source back to the general fund. So the lands were not making a difference in the education of the children. They were being managed with very divided loyalty because the Department of Natural Resources had some very awesome responsibilities on conservation and preservation. And it's very difficult to say to someone, on this piece, you're to conserve and preserve, but on this piece, you're to make money. And we also found it difficult because many times during the summer when we have our forest fire season, the people that should have been making money from the school lands when the snow was melted were instead out putting out the fires. And so it was very difficult. We put them in a position that it was impossible to accomplish both objectives. We had school lands that were being used for Department of Natural Resource missions. It was going to state parks with no compensation. We had land that was going to wildlife resources for wildlife preserves. We had land not very far from Salt Lake City, 2,000 acres. It sold for $12 an acre. And we knew that was not market value.
I'm sorry, ma'am. Could you repeat the price of that?
Pardon?
Could you repeat the price of that, please?
Yes. We had about 2,000 acres that were sold for $12 an acre to the Division of Wildlife Resources. And we knew it was not the market value of that property.
Thank you.
There were low financial returns to our schools. There was little accountability. When records were requested, it was often 9 months to a year before we actually received the data back. Too late to do any action on that. We had a system that was very fraught with political favors. And the worst thing of all is you could ask the state superintendent at the time, you could ask anyone in education, how is that money making a difference? It's a trust for children. How is it making a difference in their lives and their education? And not one of us could point to what it did. So we had a situation that was ripe for change. When we began, I've had a number of people say to me, well, but change is so difficult. Change is difficult for humans. We tend to like things the way they are, and there's something about something changing where we don't know exactly how it's going to happen, that we have an innate resistance to that change. We were opposed by every major group in our state in terms of lobbying when we began. The ranching community thought we were part of No Moo by 92, that anti-grazing movement. The environmental community was suspicious. They were sure we were getting organized because we wanted to kill their wilderness proposals. Petroleum and mining were certain that they were going to drive them out of business. Natural resources, of course, did not want us to leave the Department of Natural Resources and take all those school trust lands with us. Forestry and timber were opposed because they were certain we were going to stop any logging any further on any of our lands. The Association of Counties were all opposed because they were just downright suspicious. We definitely were part of No Moo. We were definitely anti-environment, all of those things. And some in education even opposed making a change to the school trust lands. Primarily those were people on local school boards who were also grazers. And so it looked like an impossible uphill climb to us when we began. And it was very illuminating, I think, to a lot of these groups when we helped them understand, if you don't make money, we don't make money. And to help the counties understand, if we do something on land that increases its value, then you're going to have increased tax revenues. It was not impossible, but it was a hard upward climb to do that. Prior to 1994, we were the poster child on everything that you didn't want to do on your school lands. And land commissioners across the western states, where most of the trust lands remain, never seemed to fail to point out how bad we were. Because if someone criticized them on something, they would just simply say, oh, but look at Utah. They're doing 10 times worse. And then they looked a whole lot better. We had the lowest permanent fund in the nation at $18 million. The next lowest was Nevada at $270-something million. So we were way the last. We had the lowest surface leases, lease rates to the federal government. We would lease military sites for 11 cents an acre. We had the lowest grazing fee in the nation by far. We were among the states with the very lowest revenue, even though we had 3.5 million acres. And no one knew how much revenue came to education. We couldn't even find and I work for the Department of Education, we could not find the number of how much money had come in any given year. In 1994, our legislature had a very powerful man named Representative Mel Brown. Some of you may know him. He is a two-time speaker of the Utah House of Representatives, though he wasn't at that time. His brother was also a speaker in the House of Representatives, and I believe that's the only family in America that's ever produced two speakers in state houses of representatives. He was a former teacher for 18 years, and he started teaching legislators about their fiduciary duty on school trust lands. Our legislature was horrified to hear what a poor job we'd done. 100 years, we'd sold 3.5 million acres, and we had $18 million to show for it. At that point, they decided there was nothing they could do about their failure from the past, but there was a lot they could do about the future for children. And so they chose at that point to say, we are going to honor our fiduciary duty to the children of this state. We are going to make some changes. They quoted numerous times that punctilio of honor. I love that word, the most sensitive, and used that as the standard. They removed the trust lands from the Department of Natural Resources. They set the trust up on a corporate structure so that it was set up to make money, because that was the reason it was granted in the first place. And they made the trust quasi-independent. These are the results of having paid attention to the trust and made some changes. You can see the tremendous growth in our permanent fund from $18 million to $1.3 billion. It is making a real difference in the lives of children in our schools right now. I'm pleased to let you know that, and to be able to report to you, that every major lobbying group that opposed us initially are all tremendously supportive. And there isn't a group listed up there Well, maybe the Department of Natural Resources, because I don't usually have to go talk to them about it. But the other groups are all groups that I regularly meet with them before the legislative session. They share their legislative concerns. We share ours. And we work together with our legislature. It has become a wonderful experience. Our legislature is so supportive. And when Kevin Carter goes out there to tell them something he needs, I can't recall a time he hasn't gotten it. But it's because they've seen what that permanent fund has done. And it's also because of one other thing that I want to briefly mention to you. And that is, in our state, what we now do is we now put the money from the trust into every single school. There is a community council in every school composed of a majority of parents elected by the parents, teachers elected by the teachers, and the principal. And that school community council decides the academic need that school has. So one school might need smart boards. Another school might need those sound systems because they have a number of deaf children that are struggling to hear. A different school might need tutors to help children learn to speak English quicker and get up to speed. Somebody else might have their science labs funded this way, their computer labs funded, online testing funded from the trust. And so each school makes its own decision of how they most need to improve academically, and they use these trust fund monies to do that. It has made a huge difference, and as legislators, you might be interested in this. Representative Brown required every school to report to their community how they're spending the money, which has meant that the schools write their legislators. They tell you what they're doing with the money. They tell you how their test scores have gone from X percent to Y percent because of the tutors that they had to help the children in writing or whatever the issue was. And the legislators love it because I've had so many legislators tell me, you know, it seems like the only letters I get are letters of somebody complaining about something in state government. And instead, now I get these school trust land letters from the community councils, and they're saying, thank you so much, legislator, for letting this money come to me, senator or representative. And the representatives and senators have loved it because they've been invited to the school to see how it's really making a difference. I'll turn the time over to Director Carter.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for that presentation. The question I have, just a little perspective here on looking at that chart from 1994 to 2011. Can you tell me what revenue difference there is per child from 1994 to 2011?
I can't tell. Oh,
Mr. Chair, we have done an approximation that for every additional $1 million you add to the trust fund, that would equate to, and these are rough numbers, so please don't hold me to it, about $1 per pupil on the basic formula.
Once. Is that Utah's numbers or ours?
I believe those are our numbers.
I was asking that question, Madam Chair. And is that something relatively similar then what you experienced in Utah?
I can't report on 1994 because it was still going into the large pot. In 1994, we didn't pass the school land trust program until 2000, but I can tell you in 2000, we went from less than $5 million to next year we're expecting to be at $30 million. In terms of what goes out. We do not distribute capital gains. We plow those back in the fund to grow the fund. I can tell you that in the first year of the program, it was approximately, probably $10 or less per student. I haven't looked at those numbers for a while, but I think it was around $9 and something per student in 2000, and by next year, 2012-13, it will, let me give you this year because I know this year. It's $50 per student in our largest districts and along our urban areas, and it's about $500 a student in our smaller districts in the rural areas, because 10% of the formula provides an advantage to smaller rural districts, so that overall a school gets enough money to put in a computer lab or whatever.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, who's chairing today?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, how many students does Utah have?
We have about, You have a different system than we do.
Yes.
We have approximately 550,000 students, and we're the fastest growing school system in the nation.
And Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, how many students do we have in Minnesota?
I think it's right around 800 and some thousand, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Higgins.
Thank you.
So, okay, if there are no more questions, Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Carter, and I'm the Director of Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. And I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today about our experience with school trust lands and converting from a model that was similar to what you have in Minnesota to the model that Mrs. Bird described earlier. Before 1994, our Division of State Lands and Forestry was a division within a Department of Natural Resources. The director of the division served at the pleasure of the executive director of Department of Natural Resources, but essentially it was at the pleasure of the governor. The revenues from our earnings were often used to subsidize other functions within the Department of Natural Resources, most often the forestry arm of the agency. The management focus of the agency was patterned after federal government land management agencies like the BLM, where there was a multitude of activities and tasks that they wanted the agency to cover, one of which, and subservient to most of the others, was generating revenue for the school system. Almost all of the employees within the division at that time were merit or civil service employees. With the change in 1994, we were instructed to become more like a business and less like a government, and to act in that manner. The director, instead of being at the will of an executive director under the governor, became an appointed office for a four-year term, which provided enough independence that difficult decisions could be made for the benefit of the trust, even if it wasn't politically popular. Unlike other agencies, the new Trust Lands Administration is entirely self-funded. Our revenues... Bless you. Our revenues provide all of our funding, and we don't take any tax monies to help run the agency. Most of our employees now are at-will employees, like any business would be. They work at will. This is a map of the state of Utah, and it's kind of difficult to see some of the colors, but the yellowish background that you see there are lands that are federal lands that are administered by the BLM. It's hard to see. There's a green spine that goes up the center of the state that's Forest Service, and then the darker green is Forest Service Wilderness. The pinkish down at the bottom is National Park and National Monument. And then you can see kind of a hazy background behind the yellow. Those are the scattered 1 square mile school sections that are distributed all over the state. And so there isn't very many things that we do that isn't in some way working with or working at odds with a neighboring landowner. And so we are experienced in having multiple land management agencies working the same types of issues. The Utah Supreme Court, in a ruling on trust lands in Utah, gave the legislature this direction. And fundamentally, they said, you need to manage these lands and instruct an agency to manage these lands as a trust. And the focus should be the beneficiaries and not other institutions. So one of the things operating like a business that you have to expect is accountability. And so we produce reports such as this one where every month we examine what our income sources are doing, what their costs are, and then the most important information is this third column where we compare revenue to expenses. And if any of these numbers start to approach one, then I know that I've got a problem. It's that one of my groups is not going to make enough money to support themselves. Thankfully, so far, no one has gotten to that point. But if someone did, if one of the groups stopped making more money than it costs to run the program, we'd have to seriously examine whether or not we should maintain doing that. I mean, if it costs us more than we can earn, it doesn't seem prudent to do it. There's also significant oversight to our agency. Mrs. Bird works for the State Office of Education. They have a group whose sole function, well, one of several functions anyway, is to provide oversight to our office and to make sure that the actions that we are taking are fiduciarily sound and make sense for the beneficiaries. Every year, the State Auditor's Office comes in and audits our books to make sure that there hasn't been any transactions that are fraudulent. And periodically, maybe once a decade, the Legislative Auditor General sends auditors to our office to look at how we're doing everything that we do from soup to nuts and determine whether or not we're meeting the mandate that they gave us. Also, every year we have to go before a Legislative Appropriation Committee for our budget appropriation, where we have to defend every dollar that we're going to spend on trust land management in the coming year so that they have oversight on how we're spending the trust monies. The result of acting like business instead of government has been this type of revenue to our beneficiaries. This is a net revenue table. If you were to take the 1994 column and run backwards to probably 1960, you wouldn't see that column changing very much in height. Our revenue was about $10 to $15 million a year for as far back as several decades. And then in 1994, when we were created, you can see the changes that started to occur and the increases in revenue that started to come about. The result was, as Mrs. Bird has mentioned, a significant increase in our permanent trust fund from $18 million in 1994 after 100 years of putting money into the trust fund to $1.3 billion at the end of 2011. And so a significant demonstration of the results of this type of management. I wanted to make sure that you understood, though, that even with a focus on our fiduciary duties as trustees over this land, we still are able to exercise responsible stewardship management over the critical resources that are on our lands. For example, this petroglyph is on a piece of school trust land in central Utah. It's a world-famous rock art piece. It's called The Great Hunt. You can see the Native Americans there with their bows and arrows shooting at the desert bighorn sheep. And I'd swear that one in the bottom right-hand corner looks like the Kool-Aid Man, but it's got to be an anachronism. But if you draw back away from that panel and look where the oval is there, that's the panel. And then on the left and the right of the screen, you'll see arrows pointing off, diverging from there. That was where a previous road came through this area. The road was so close as it bent around the corner there where the panel was that the mirrors on the vehicles could actually scour the panel as they went by. We worked with a lessee, an oil and gas lessee that we had in the area. They put up the money, and we had the road rerouted away from there. We blocked off the road so that traffic couldn't come through and built these protective barriers and places for people to sit and enjoy this remarkable piece of historic evidence, and all at no expense to the taxpayer, but just because it's the right thing to do as a steward over the land. We also have significant wildlife issues that we have to take care of on our lands where there happen to be threatened or endangered species. The flower on the right is the dwarf bear claw poppy, which is a federally listed species under the Endangered Species Act, and the majority of its habitat is on school trust land. It might come as a surprise to many people to learn that plants listed on the Endangered Species Act are not protected off of federal land. They're only protected under federal ownership. Animals like the desert tortoise are protected regardless of the landowner. If you happen to have an endangered animal species on your private land, then you have just giving yourself the opportunity to become much more intimate with your federal government. The cases where we have these types of resources on our lands, we realize that we're not the ultimate repository of these types of resources. Some other agencies, primarily federal agencies, are better suited to manage this type of land. So we find ways to convey it to the federal government in exchange for lands that have income-producing opportunities instead. And so during the interim, though, until we can make that exchange happen, we provide the full amount of protection that these resources need. In addition to just offering protection, in some cases, there's opportunities for creative management that will actually provide a way to generate revenue off of this type of situation. This is the Utah prairie dog, and it's an endangered species that occurs in southern Utah on our land and on a lot of private land and on some federal land. They particularly like backyards and golf courses and cemeteries. They like grassy areas that don't have overstory where they can make sure they're not going to get picked up by a circling eagle or falcon or something. They have encroached. Well, there's been mutual encroachment. The urban development has encroached upon their habitat, and they've encroached in the backyards as a result of a lot of residential areas in the southern Utah community. And they are they're fairly aggressive. They look really cute, but they'll charge you if you come at them in your backyard. And as disturbing as that might be, even more disturbing is most of them are carrying Sylvatic plague, and so you don't want to handle them. So we've had this problem where people can't enjoy their private property or to develop on their private property because of the presence of the prairie dog. And so we found a piece of our property, a trust land property, away from the urban areas that's suitable for habitat. We've improved it so that it makes good habitat, and then we translocate prairie dogs onto our property for a fee. The going rate's about $2,000 a dog right now. And by doing that, we have taken what otherwise would have been an impact on our land that would prevent us from using it and turned it into a money-making opportunity for the school trust. We have lots of other sensitive lands in Utah, very scenic lands. This particular arch is a Corona Arch. It happens to be also on a piece of school trust land. It's not within Arches National Park. Just to give you an idea of the size of this arch, if you look at if you look at this little spot right there that's being highlighted, those are people underneath the arch right there, to give you an idea of how big that is. There's actually a picture in Moab in one of the restaurants of an airplane flying through this arch. So this is a big scenic attraction. And we recognize that we're not the ultimate holder of this type of land. It's not what we do. But until we can find a way to get it into the ownership of somebody who does have that responsibility, it is protected. And we'll make sure that no harm comes to it. It's protected and people can go and enjoy it. Ultimately, we need to get it out of our ownership. It's not the type of asset that we would routinely manage and could use. But in addition to just the striking beauty that it has, we've learned recently that it has other attractions. Yeah, we would be glad to facilitate any swings that anybody would like to come out and take a shot at it. And, hop onto YouTube someday and type in Corona Arch Swing. There's probably a couple of dozen different people that have filmed themselves making the jump.
And there's a charge for that, I presume.
We would talk about a charge probably if we needed to, yeah. The concern I have about a charge for it is it might increase our liability there. But
Madam Chair, if I could, I'll take you up on that if you'll jump into that hole of ice I'm going to do in about another week and a half.
No way.
Yeah, this was not a challenge. This was an offer. Yeah. But I think finally, as far as land stewardship goes, since our beginning in 1994, we have taken actions that have resulted in the preservation of over 550,000 acres of trust lands in Utah. which is significantly greater than all of the conservation and environmental groups in Utah's results combined. And so there is not a conflict between responsible trust land management and good stewardship. And that is my presentation. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, just real quickly before we open it up for questions, in conclusion, you know, kind of to bring it back to us here in Minnesota, we're in a situation where in 1908, Minnesota had the second largest trust fund in the nation at around $20 million. In 2010, we see that now as $674 million, and we're in the lowest third in the nation. So if I can leave this informational hearing, if I can leave you with one thing from this informational hearing, it would be that we can do better. We can do better for the children of Minnesota. You know, I think we take a look at this, and as we educate ourselves on this, it's very clear to understand that these lands are set aside for the children of Minnesota, not the Department of Education, not the Department of Natural Resources, but very specifically set aside for the children of Minnesota. And I think as trustees, due to our fiduciary obligations, we really need to make a mental paradigm shift from one of what I would call stagnation in the results we're seeing from these lands to one of making sure that we can maximize the revenue stream coming out of that trust fund. And I think what we see in the Utah model is a model that allows us to do that while still respecting the wildlife and the natural resources that we have come to love here in Minnesota. What are the things that I was excited when I first started talking to Mr. Carter about was many of the things, or at least a portion of the things that they've been able to do in Utah, do not have anything to do with natural resources. They've been able to do some great things in real estate investment and some things that do not actually tax the natural resources at all. And I think that's something that we could learn from here in Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. One of the things that it's obvious that you've got some resources there that you draw on that gave you some significant income, probably your gas, oil, other kinds of mining. And we've had some of that same experience here. That's where the best return is. And I think the School Trust Fund Advisory Committee has been working to try to also get some of our lands out of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area that's owned by the federal government. We have school trust fund lands there that are we can do nothing with. And kind of negotiating both the land exchange or outright sale is taking, you know, more time. I don't know if you've obviously done some kinds of exchanges there, too, and if you have any recommendations of how to speed up that process, dealing with the federal government, I think that could be useful as well. But I think perhaps you have other questions, members, in terms of how this structure. It's obvious that there have been some elements there that are different, and if you want to probe and get some more from these folks while they're here, I urge you to do so. It looks like Senator Saxog is ready to try.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'd like to thank our friends from Utah for coming, because there's no question about it that what you've done in taking care of your trust has been very important to the school children of the state of Utah. You know, our problem is that we've got 5 million acres of trust fund and 4 million is forests. And then a chunk of that is, as Madam Chair has said, is in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. So we have our own set of problems. I was just going to ask Senator Cruz how he visualizes through what he's talking about there in terms of management, how you plan to kind of improve our forest management.
Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, I think that is a great question, and I think that is something that as we move forward on this legislation, and as we get a director like Mr. Carter in charge, as we get a citizen council that has specific knowledge in those areas, whether it be mining, whether it be forestry. That's what they do in the private sector. I think we're going to have some of those questions answered for us. So right now, the way I envision this is we are putting the structure in place to allow those better decisions to happen. If I had to take just a shot at it myself, without that expertise in forestry, that I think I would need to truly give the question a just answer. I think, one of the things that I know we do here in Minnesota is with fire suppression, and I know that a lot of the fire suppression that goes on throughout the state gets charged to the trust land, and there's some other things that I think we could probably manage a little bit better there. And I would also say, just kind of focusing on what I know to be rotation in areas where it is.
Can I just direct, Mr. Carter, what were some of the things, actions that were taken in Utah? Because I think that was an area that you were able to increase the revenue to the trust fund where it was going for other purposes. Could you describe that a little bit in more detail?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. If I might address that question. I think one of the things that focused trust management provides is the opportunity to look at opportunities that you hadn't considered before and to branch out into things that you previously didn't realize that you had the opportunity to do. For example, we did not anticipate that we would be a real estate development company, but we've made $250 million in real estate over that 16-year period. We also didn't realize that there was a chance to acquire a huge underground salt dome that we could lease to somebody who's using solution mining to mine out caverns in there that they can store natural gas in. And they can also store compressed air. And the interesting of storing the compressed air is that we have a wind farm nearby. And as those of you who are familiar with wind energy, you can't rely upon it when you might need the energy. The wind blows when the wind blows, and the lights go on when the lights go on, and often ne'er the twain do meet. But what you can do with a cavern like this is that you can use the energy that you're generating during off-peak times and pump compressed air into this cavern, and then when it's peak energy times, you can let the compressed air back out to generate electricity with turbines. I mean, there's all kinds of creative things that you can do with the resources you have if you focus on your fiduciary duty.
I was kind of trying to keep you in the forestry area. Maybe that's
Well, Madam Chair, I'll just follow up by saying, with what you're saying, sir, I agree with that, and we have the same sorts of opportunities than our mining lands. They're infinitely more valuable than our forest lands, which are much more intensive, labor intensive. But that's kind of I'm back to my question on how we solve this. I mean, whether we establish something to solve the problem, or do we study it and then establish some type of a commission. But just one more question, and I think that I heard this right, that Utah does not use general fund for any type of management of any of the resources. And I'm just wondering, I know that you don't have a lot of forests, so would we, Senator Cruz, would you be thinking about using general fund money to determine if to help us do manager for us, or what were you thinking?
Madam Chair and Senator Saxhawk, I would envision this essentially being managed within its own budget. That's kind of the way we have this legislation set up. I think as we take a broader look, and you hit the nail on the head when you speak about what are the resources that are available? We have these great mining resources that are available, and where are these lands positioned to help us take advantage of those resources? And I think, as Mr. Carter has spoken, that gets right back to the fiduciary obligation that we have. And I would envision that we would be able to work all of the management piece out of the budget that is generated by the revenue here.
So, Madam Chair, you wouldn't see that any of the forest management would come out of general fund, not fire suppression or anything?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Saxog, I would like to see that limited to what is needed to specifically manage the trust lands. I don't know that I would consider it fair to have the children of Minnesota paying for fire suppression for lands that are outside of those school trust lands. So I think if that needs to be something that it obviously does, you know, it's something that is very important. We need to make sure that we have money set aside for that. But I think that outside of those trust fund areas, we need to make sure that we are, you know, we're not taxing the school trust lands for resources that aren't there. So is that making sense?
Well,
Senator Cruz, he's asking about whether it's coming out of the general fund. Aren't you suggesting that those costs would come out of the income on the trust, from the trust fund lands rather than using general fund? Right, that's what's happening now.
Correct.
But more of it, you'd like to spend less of it.
Correct. That's right, Madam Chair.
Does the bill address any of that or not?
No, the bill primarily addresses, Madam Chair and Senator Saxon, the bill primarily addresses the management piece. And some of these other things, I think, will come out through the conversations in the committee hearings and through other legislation as we talk about land swaps and things like that. But I guess to answer that question, if I had a preference, if there was need coming out of the general, and maybe I'm not understanding the question correctly, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but Madam Chair and Senator Saxog, are you asking if general fund dollars would be used to provide fire suppression on school trust lands, and that those dollars would not come out of the school trust fund?
Exactly. But Madam Chair, we can talk about this as a committee. I don't want to take time away from our guests.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I had some questions along the same line. Senator Cruz, nowhere in the bill that I can find does it say, how big a department this is, what level this director person will be, will he be, he or she be at a commissioner level? How does he fit into the state governments? How much does he get paid? Who gets to decide that? Is he a direct report to the governor? I see we have a policy-making commission. I don't see a budget. I don't. And again, I had the same question: is the director and however many staff he gets to decide all on his own? Are they paid through the trust fund? All that kind of thing that
Senator
I'm kind
Higgins,
of curious about.
We are not here to discuss the bill today. We're here to take advantage of the resource we have from Utah. So why don't you just rephrase that question?
All right, so I'll try it on a different.
Ask them how Utah, what's the size of their agency or whatever that kind of cost.
Good idea.
So
I'll
go
that way.
Use of them while we have them.
Okay,
here.
Sir. How big a department do you have that does this work? Can I just have a whole series of questions then, Madam Chair? I'll rattle on.
Well,
sir?
Just so that we let others ask some questions,
yeah,
too.
But it's all related to this.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Senator, our agency is 75 people. We have a operating budget of about $10 million a year. We have a capital budget in addition to that that's appropriated to us to make investments on the property to increase its value and to prepare it for whatever market activity we want to prepare it for. We have I'm trying to anticipate what your future questions will be. We have four major groups in the agency that deal with oil and gas, hard rock minerals, surface activities like land sales and easements and rights of way and grazing and forestry, and then a group that deals with real estate development. We have about four or five full-time attorneys, and I've got a staff of about three or four archaeologists.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Carter, and you're the director of the department, and are you at the same level in the state government bureaucracy as the commissioner of DNR, for example?
Madam Chair and Senator, Essentially, yes, but I'm not part of the governor's cabinet because I don't work for the governor. We're a quasi-independent agency. I'm hired by a board of trustees for a four-year term, and at the time that I'm hired, the governor has to concur in the hiring, but after that, I'm not under the direct supervisory control of the governor.
And then, Madam Chair and Mr. Senator Carter, are you paid, you and your 75 employees, are they paid through state government, like the general fund appropriation, or are you paid through your trust fund?
Madam Mr. Chair, Carter. We're paid from our revenues.
From your revenues. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Carter, mm-hmm. If somebody came and wanted to put a big amusement park or off-road vehicle playground kind of thing on any of your trust fund land, how do you decide whether that is in the best interest of the state? Whether to allow that to happen or not,
Mr. Carter,
Madam
something
Chair
that would bring
Senator,
a lot of people. All that.
If you'll recall from a previous slide, in the best interest of the state is not really the criterion that we use. It's what's in the best interest of our beneficiaries. That's the standard that we use. And so we determine whether or not the activity, number one, is lawful. Number two, does the person who wants to do it, are they capable financially and in other ways capable of doing what they are proposing they're going to do? Are there sufficient protections in place so that if they prove not capable, can the land be restored if there's been any damage or anything like that to it? And then are there alternative competing uses that are more financially viable for that piece of property? So those are the things that we'll look at normally.
Madam Chair, my last question then. Mr. Carter, could you give us an example of a couple of enterprises that you might have turned down because they didn't fit that criteria?
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair and Senator, we turned down a pig hunting operation because the state veterinarian was concerned that releasing feral pigs into this area would have livestock and other disease problems, and so we didn't pursue that. But you know, there are a lot of things that do go on. I mean, I've got a rocket sled test track facility on the Mesa Top in Winnipeg where they test ejection seats for jet vehicles. I mean, so you know, there are a lot of things that you can do on land that are creative and interesting. The what?
The hover thing for Toyota.
We've got a lot of commercials, a lot of movie filming. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make a plug here. Go see John Carter from Mars coming out in a week or so. It was filmed on trust land in Utah.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Senator Keeler.
One of my questions for you, Mr. Carter, is that when this new trust was established, was there also language that was limiting the investments prior that were opened up? Is there any changes in what qualified as an investment for you compared to, previous? In other words, did your investment options open up with the new organization you established?
Madam Chair, if I may, can I redirect that question to Mrs. Bird because she's more familiar with those aspects?
Ms. Bird.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. We made huge changes in how we invested the permanent fund. When I first, my background is in economics, and when I first got involved in this issue, we had a permanent fund that was invested for liquidity. Now, who invests something that's supposed to be permanent for liquidity? Like any moment you're going to have to cash in on it. And the legislature is cautious when it comes to financial changes. So we took baby steps. We got rid of some of the strange wording we had in our statute that allowed for certain types of investments and didn't allow for other types of investments. Then we slowly moved toward our ultimate goal, which was the prudent investor rule I believe you have the prudent person rule in Minnesota, which is a step down from prudent investor. Prudent investor says that, first of all, that it has to be invested by people that have investment background, and that they have to act as any prudent investor would in those circumstances. Prudent person rule simply requires you have to act as a prudent person without that knowledge would. The largest trust funds are all invested under prudent investor rule. Mm-hmm. Texas.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Keeley.
So did the legislature need to make the changes, or did the legislature grant the new trust fund management the ability to change those investment rules and restrictions?
Madam Chair, the agency that Director Carter manages the land only. Then the funds are given to the state treasurer, who invests them with an investment advisory committee. On our investment advisory committee, we have people that we could no more afford to have if we had to pay them what they charge mm-hmm. others. But they are people who volunteer their time. The Huntsman Corporation's chief financial officer is there. The Wasatch Advisors president, one of the most successful small cap firms, their president is on there. We have one man that owns a huge Summit Capital out of California, but he likes to raise his kids in Utah, so he's on there. We have that caliber of investor on the investment advisory committee. So the state treasurer, the legislature made changes to the statute, abolished all those kind of strange restrictions and different things, and put the prudent investor rule in place and defined it in statute.
Ms. Bird, this bill wouldn't change. We've got a very good State Board of Investment, and I think it's the intention to stay with that. Now, I'm interested and not very knowledgeable about this difference of prudent person versus prudent investor standard, whether I think that ought to be discussed and determine whether there's any merit to it whether it would enhance the investment quality of that trust fund versus one way or the other, because they do very well with our retirement funds and
they
other
do.
Kinds of things. Our State Board of Investment, I think we've got a pretty good reputation there. So I don't know the model that you've had is quite the same as what we have and would probably want to preserve.
Madam Chair, you have a very good return. I believe last year you were at 12.3%, or at least that's what your investment board reported to class.
Great. Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carter, in looking over the bill, which I'm sure you probably have over the last couple of days you've been here, and again, thank you both for coming, the makeup of the committee, is that similar to what you have, or have you looked at that? What's your opinion about the makeup of the committee? It seems to be very non-political, if you will, at least numbers-wise on each side.
Madam Chair, Senator, our board is a board of trustees, is composed of seven people. They are appointed, six of them are appointed for rotating six-year terms. So we have six, and one goes off and is replaced every year. The seventh is appointed at large by the governor, and he serves at the pleasure of the governor. The statute lays out the requirements that the board members must have in order to serve on our board. It's either they have to have a background in one of the extractive industries or natural resources or real estate development or the types of things that we're in business to do. It's those types of people. Now, primarily, their role is policy making and to provide direction on how we move ahead with our transactions and activities. But if we have an application come before us that's outside of the norm, that's beyond something that's already provided for in rule, then they act as an executive board at that time in hearing that and making a decision on whether or not to approve that transaction. So that's their duties and that's the makeup. They are not they are not elected officials.
Yes, Madam Chair. I want to make it very clear, too, those appointments that are made to that Board of Trustees are made, the governor doesn't have anyone to choose from. There's a nominating committee comprised in large part of education and users that are almost balanced, and then the other beneficiaries, the University of Utah and Utah State University, have a person that sits on there. So education has the majority vote on the names that go to the governor. The governor makes his selection from two names. So that's how we've removed politics from it, because the users of the land have every reason to want the land to be managed professionally and dependably so they can depend on it. And the beneficiaries want to make sure that it's managed in a prudent and profitable manner. So that's why we go through a nominating committee to come up with the names.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned the university. In our case, there are university trust fund lands, too, but because the university was formed before the state, I don't think they come under any... Are they managed in our state by our state government? So they're managed there, and also the investment is done through the State Board of Investment? Okay,
yes.
So I don't know if we've addressed that in terms of coming under. You're looking at just the school trust fund in terms of this particular structure. Okay, somebody, Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I had a question for either testifier on the formula. In Minnesota, we provide a student the same amount regardless of where he or she lives. In the distribution, you mentioned for rural, I believe it was nearly $500 or so per student or whatever it was. There was a difference. But ultimately, we all agree it's the students in the classroom, it's the beneficiary, and you provide reports. Now, was this a legislative determination, a commission determination? What's the policy reasoning for having a difference in funding?
Good question. Chair. Ms. Bird.
Yes. What we do is 90% of the distribution each year is based on per pupil. 90% is based on per pupil. And 10% is based on it's split evenly among each of the school districts. On the urban school districts that are very large, that each district takes its 10%, its portion of the 10%, and its per pupil amount, puts it together, and distributes a per pupil amount to their students. We have, like you have, some areas of our state that are sparsely populated, and the schools are very, very small. Maybe ours are even smaller. And in those areas, we wanted to make sure that they had enough money. I mean, we have some schools that have 12 students. And so we wanted to make sure that they still had enough money to do something more than buy, you know, three books. So the feeling was unanimous among the education community, let's split the 10% evenly among the districts and then have it go out. So what that results in is the largest district gets about $50 a student, and the smallest district, and it is tiny, it's like just barely 100 students in the whole district. It gets about $500 a student, but it still allows them enough money that if they want to buy a computer, they can, those kinds of things.
And, Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. Is this a determination by the commission or the legislature, and is there a parallel in funding between the two?
Madam Chair, yes, it was a determination by the legislature that they wanted that distributed that way. There are movements afoot right now to consider just doing it on a per pupil basis, because the money's gotten large enough now that even those really tiny schools on a per pupil basis would have enough. But, you know, those in the rural area have inordinate control within the legislature, and they're not going to give that up easily. I don't know. Maybe it's happened while I've been out of town, but I can't foresee that.
As that should be.
Senator Higgins.
Can we go from the rural senator to the inner city senator here? I'm trying to find in all the paperwork, and I can't put my hands on it, but I think I heard that the vast majority of the revenue that comes in Utah for the trust land is from oil and gas and coal. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, yes, Senator, that is correct.
Year in, year out, about 65 to maybe 85%, depending on the year, the revenue comes from
oil, natural gas, and coal. Oil being the smallest component of that of those three, coal being next, and then natural gas.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Carter,
Senator Higgins,
in the other land. So I guess what's my question? The thing that's so different about that aspect of the Utah school trust is that, and Minnesota's, is we don't have them, and we have trees, and mining, maybe there might be some.
I think you have a significant resource in mining.
You know that.
Not in all those millions of acres, I don't think.
Ms. Byrd?
I did a report, Madam Chair, I did a report last year for the Western States Land Commissioners Association on every one of the states that have trust lands. And you're about half and half, half minerals and half forestry, which isn't that unusual. It's not that far off from where we are. Our surface uses may not be forestry, but we have other surface uses that in good economic times bring in a lot more, like when we have more happening on our residential development. But the purpose of this is not to say we have exactly the same land you have, but the purpose is to say a thoughtful consideration of fiduciary duty and a thoughtful consideration of how to make the lands productive to school children can result in huge benefits to your children.
Yes. If there are no further questions, I think we will thank you folks for coming and spending these days with us, and I think you've given us a lot of thought-provoking notions as we venture into trying to get a better return on our investment for our, and carry out our trustee duty as well.
Thank you for your hospitality.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. It has just been a beautiful experience. We have loved being in Minnesota. I think you have the most beautiful capital of all the capitals I've seen, and I've been to a lot of them. It is absolutely awe-inspiring. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, and we're trying to preserve that,
Madam
too.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I should point out that the capital was paid for by mining, which was up in the other.
Yes. It
was just, that's why it's so beautiful.
Was it $50,000 that it cost when it was built?
It was $5
million. $5 million. Yeah, that's $5 million. Governor's residence. It was $50,000.
That I don't know.
Yes.
And I don't know if we paid for that one.
That was donated.
Center Council. Huh? You got to cover the repairs as well.
you see all these?
You see all that
money in the school trust fund comes from mining. Look at here, Miller.
So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over to
thank you, Madam
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank the members for this joint committee. Also, I want to recognize Commissioner Landwehr. I apologize for not getting your folks on today. We're going to be hearing this bill at least two, for sure, three times. So I think the folks here will be involved in a lot of dialogue coming up, and we're looking forward to the presentation of your folks. So thank you so much for coming.
With that, unless there's anything else.
Madam Chair, just kind of a housekeeping question. The papers that we have, if we're coming back to this, can we just keep them in our folder?
I think you can. In our folders, there is a place to save, but I would instruct our legislative assistant, if you put them in your folder and leave them here, that they will be saved for the.
All right.
There you go.
Meeting is adjourned.